I would like to tell the speakers for questions. And I ask the audience to send us the questions, if you please. We have time. Well, as the chairman of the session, I would like to ask you a question to Dr. Ixler. Yeah. Do you know these studies that they use mycophenolate in rats with hypertension and chronic renal failure, and the lesions became, well, almost disappeared? Do you remember those studies by Rodriguez y Turbe? Does that have something to do with the Tarnesept effects or similar to?
I mean, it is possible that there is some anti-inflammatory effects just because of the immunosuppression, and one can not rule out. Yes. But whether there's an additional pathway that's involved in terms of improving fibrosis, I'm not sure, to tell the truth. I don't think that will do it in CKD in general in humans, but interesting idea.
Well, I have a question also for Dr. McIntyre. Is a trial of bronchodilators justified in the snake patients in hemodialysis without fluid overload?
It's a very good question. I think it's a bit early to answer it yet. Those methods of very accurately measuring ventilatory volumes within the lungs have been applied to people with COPD. So they've taken patients with COPD who've had formal lung function tests with bronchodilator challenge and those and have been classified as being bronchodilator sensitive, and then those that don't. And then when they actually measure the ventilatory volumes, both groups increase the ventilatory volumes, not detected by standard spirometry. So we're going to apply those same methods and see if we can find objective evidence of a change in ventilatory volumes. And maybe if we had that, it would be worthwhile.
What about muscular force in our patients with dialysis, that they have sarcopenia and they develop?
They do, and that is probably also a distinct factor in terms of the dyspnea and the poor exercise tolerance the patients have, but has only been studied rigorously in non-renal patients.
There's a question for Dr. Amadero. Is the allopurinol effect a blood pressure effect?
That's a very good question. Could be. I mean, as you can see, some of these trials, you know, the reduction of blood pressure medications is impressive in the trials. And in this first study I show you by Shu, blood pressure reduces significantly. So it could be. You know, my own experience of giving allopurinol in patients with chronic kidney disease is that, you know, if the kidney disease is not very advanced, the impact is higher. Like, you know, we've given allopurinol to healthy subjects with hypertension and the blood pressure reduces significantly. And when we do ABPMs, you know, the blood pressure dipping, the dippers actually increase, the percentage of dippers increase. However, you know, when you go into more advanced CKD, you know, our experience is that the impact of allopurinol on blood pressure is not as impressive. But yes, it could be one of the mechanisms that account for this. And I think vascular stiffness may be another one.
Well, there's another question here for Dr. Ixler. Is there any thoughts regarding the data by Auge?
Sevelamer is known to be an anti.
Sevelamer, yes.
Yeah, Sevelamer has got some anti-inflammatory effects. There has been a couple of studies, one from Turkey, that have showed that use of Sevelamer in the kidney disease patients actually improves inflammation, published several years ago. My biggest concern is the fact that the DCOR study actually did not show a significant impact. And if a large trial with its limitations, I don't know if anybody will remember the D-course trial because it's negative, but it was a large 2,000-patient trial suggesting that use of sevelamer versus a regular phosphate binder, not improving cardiovascular events and mortality, is good enough for me to say that there's no need to go back and try to find other strategies.
Okay, that's interesting. For Dr. Mandero, there's another question here. Is your suggested approach to managing asymptomatic hyperuricemia in patients with CKD?
Well, I think we don't have strong evidence so far to support this. My own personal impression is that if the patient tolerates it, you know, there's no really harm of doing it. You know, as long as you titrate the allopurinol up, you know, adjust for GFR and make sure there's no side effects, you know, I don't really see why not. So I start treating patients with asymptomatic hyperuricemia when the uric acid is above 7. And, you know, my target is, you know, going below 6. But, you know, if I had to write the evidence, you know, it would be hard because we still do not have a strong evidence to support this. I personally do it, but.
Is there any studies about high incidence of chronic pulmonary embolism in patients in dialysis, I suppose?
Is it particularly high? It's pulmonary hypertension, certainly. How much of that pulmonary hypertension is due to subclinical undetected multiple pulmonary emboli has not been looked at systematically. That certainly doesn't match up with the autopsy-based studies that have been done. That's not been a characteristic feature within them.
That's interesting. I didn't know that.
You know, maybe because when I was a fellow, we always were told that, you know, dialysis patients would not embolize and, you know, they have bleeding tendencies, so it's not a big deal. But lately, my own experience, at least anecdotal in the clinic, is they do have clots
I think microembolism is something that is clearly existed in this type of patients. And because of the material that we use for dialysis, and you mentioned that, and I think,
and certainly if you look at the development of lung fibrosis, that's very much related to time on dialysis, and very much related to the biocompatibility of the dialysis membranes as well. Yeah. So you know that's certainly a feature. I mean, how much is classical thromboembolic disease, and how much is, for instance, the microbubbles coating and denatured protein acting as a particular trigger to that coagulation cascade, I think it's difficult to say.
I think it's one of the things that's a little bit on the vague side. People don't know is these interventions, you know, angioplasties that we do and thrombolysis that we do in these people. And I don't think that anybody really follows these. I don't know of any data if those really cause lung disease.
We get the fistula angiogram back, don't we? And we go, yay, there's no clot in it anymore. It's gone somewhere.
And usually, you know, it's anecdotally, it's not unusual that somebody, patient will say something.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, when you're doing the thrombolysis.
There's another comment about the... Well, there's a question that goes for both of you. One is the ABF, the arteriovenous fistula, and these kind of problems with the use of drugs that, prevents the appearance of embolia and obstruction of the fistulas. And the other one is the frequency of embolism coming from this type of...
I don't know, but it's probably more often than we think.
Yeah. Yes. And the hope is using those very detailed perfusion-type images, that is going to be able to give us the kind of resolution that a conventional CTPA can't.
Era el anterior, ¿verdad? Sí, eso es lo que yo creo. And also, do you think we can prevent, not in fistulas, but in catheters? And because, as a matter of fact, catheters are widely used now in many parts of the world, and a high percentage of patients, they have these type of things. And do you think with the use of what you were using to prevent clotting?
Fish oil, you mean?
With fish oil.
Yeah, so... Go ahead.
No.
So fish oil is actually, again, the study that I showed for the purposes of showing that it has some beneficial effects in cardiovascular events was initially designed to look at the effects of fish oil on AV grafts. That study has been promoted by the authors as a positive study, although it has some limitations in itself that I don't think it's worthwhile to discuss. But there's a very recent, about a month ago, a publication that came from Australia and New Zealand that showed that use of fish oil is not effective in terms of preventing thrombosis in AV fistulas.
And that was fish oil and aspirin, and that was commencing the treatment before the surgical formation. So, you know, the timing and dose as much as you can possibly do.
Yes, I think I read about that, and they say that fish oil was supposed to, and is not really something that prevents anything on that sort of problem. But
yeah, there's an editorial in JAMA that's talking about the unfulfilled and expectations from fish oil. It's been used for decades, and it's been used for many different things, and it has been unsuccessful.
It's always had a promising future.
Yeah, it's just still going to have some. Yeah. Still, it doesn't smell anymore.
No, that's certainly the old problem. Was you lost all your friends, didn't you?
There's no more questions.
Long day.
I personally thank all of 40 of you.